Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
It is Wednesday, September 8th, live from my apartment and his attic. This is the Ben Jarofsky Show. I am DJ Nate, filling in for the one and only Dr. D. Today on the program, we have the great Monroe Anderson and political strategist Jason Lee. And now, your host, Chicago Reader columnist Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Back to the Past Wednesday, and here's why. But before I go further into why calling it Back to the Past Wednesday, let's just shout out to DJ Nate, who's sitting in for Dr. D. Dr. D's got a great contract with the Ben Jarofsky Show. It's kind of like Johnny Carson back in the day. Every now and then, Dr. D just, taking the day off. Don't bother me. He's a superstar, Dr. G. One of the great producers of all time. So he took the day off. DJ Nate was nice enough to sit in for him. All is well in the universe. All right. Back to the subject at hand. Back to the past Wednesday, and here's why. I went back to the 90s last night. Years 93, 96, and 98 to be exact. The Clinton years. Yes, I was watching episode one of Impeachment. Ryan Murphy's epic 10-part series about the Monica Lewinsky got monumentally, unfairly used and abused and demeaned and denigrated by America story. You know that story, America. Stop acting like you had nothing to do with it. Starting with our president. Bill Clinton, what a sleazebag he is, and he is going to be exposed in all his baggy sleaziness. A word about Ryan Murphy, producer of the show, big fan of his work, most of it anyway. Pose, OJ series, American Horror Story. Ryan Murphy gets at the heart of things. He's got a sixth sense for the slimy underbelly of American politics, the part of politics where we pretend it's one thing, even though it's something else, the hypocrisy of it all. And that's what's at the heart of the Lewinsky-Clinton affair. Everybody involved was full of shit. Republicans who launched the impeachment like they were morally outraged by Bill Clinton's lying when it was just an opportunity to tear Clinton down. And those same Republicans lie all the freaking time. And Clinton, especially Clinton. I cannot stand the sight of Bill Clinton these days with his, oh, shucks, I'm just Bill Clinton. He uses people and throws them away when they're of no use to him. And then he's so insincere as he tries to act sincere, even as he's pretending he's just like his Elvis little imitation that he does. Oh, hi, I'm Bill Clinton. I feel your pain. Man, he has ruined it for Democrats. Absolutely ruined it. After Clinton, nobody believes a word that Democrats say. And how can you? I did not have sex with that woman. It's like the press is so outraged, the national press that is. They're so outraged over the lies of Donald Trump. The national press, the mainstream press, keeps track of Trump's lies. They count them up. And then they're outraged that the public's not outraged. Well, why should be the public be outraged by the blatant lies of Trump? Their attitude is that all politician lies. Trump is just honest about lying, which is really weird, I know, but it's kind of how a lot of people in America look at it. And when they say that all politicians lie, who are they thinking about? They're thinking about Bill Clinton. I did not have sex with that woman. By the way, the national press. Man, the national press, they look terrible in this Ryan Murphy show. First episode, anyway. I only saw one episode. Only one episode's been dropped. They're so sarcastic and condescending the way they question Paula Jones. And they're just so full of themselves. They just sneer at her. What about a bunch of elitist snobs? Remember Paula Jones? She's the reason the whole investigation of Bill Clinton's sex life got started. And Ryan Murphy is brilliant at setting it up. Republican operatives see a Paula Jones press conference and they say, let's get her some real attorneys. Let's get her to sue the president. So they hook her up with some Republican big shot attorneys in Washington, and that gets the ball rolling. Paula is driven by the ego of her husband, who's a struggling actor and wants to sort of blackmail the Clintons into getting their Hollywood producer friends. Because Clintons always has Hollywood producer friends, ladies and gentlemen, like Harvey Weinstein. Remember him? Anyway, Paula Jones' husband wants Clinton to get their Hollywood producer friends to cast him in one of their TV shows. And that's what's motivating him to get his wife to get out front and make these accusations about Clinton. It's all kind of like this blackmailing scheme. And of course, Ryan Murphy goes right for it because it's the bizarre, random quirks of human ambition that makes this so intriguing. That and the nasty, two-faced, hypocritical portrayals that are on the horizon. And you knew Ryan Murphy was going to take the deep dive into the Linda Tripp character. And she's the White House secretary who got fired and then randomly met Monica Lewinsky at the Pentagon and realized that this 22-year-old intern will be her ticket to get some big-time revenge against the Clintons. Murphy sets up that relationship in the very first episode, and you can just anticipate how Linda Tripp will use Monica Lewinsky to get back at the Clintons who fired her from the White House, and then the Republicans in turn will use Linda Tripp to launch an investigation that they hope will bring Clinton down, and none of it, absolutely none of it, will have anything to do with anything that's real in the lives of ordinary American citizens. It will not get anybody health care or a job or education, or a cleaner environment, or better schools, or safer streets. It's just all about raw ambition and hate. So as a TV show, man, I eat it up. Why? Because it exposes the great fraud of American politics. And I'm hooked. I'll be watching. Commercials and all. We got a great show today, everybody. Monroe Anderson. It's Wednesday, so Monroe Anderson will be with us. He's no fan of Bill Clinton. Well, actually, I should hold back and let Monroe do his own talking on that one. And then our man from Texas, great political strategist, Jason Lee, will be joining us, weighing in on the insanity of Texas politics, the insanity that's led Texas to essentially outlaw abortion and pretend they're not outlawing abortion with their vigilante law, their bounty hunter law. We talked about it yesterday with Jim Coogan, and we're going to get to the politics of it. Jason Lee knows Texas about as well as anybody, political strategist, has worked in Texas and Chicago. Will this work out for Republicans? Will outlawing abortion in one of the largest, I think the second largest state in the country, giving a model for other states to follow in terms of outlawing abortion, will that be the ticket for success for Republicans? Jason Lee will answer those questions when he's on, and maybe do a little Bill Clinton talk as well. I'm sure Jason Lee, as young as he is, has a few thoughts about Bill Clinton. And, of course, if Jason Lee's on the show, we'll do a little discussion about crime. We always discuss crime, Democrats, city of Chicago, and Jason Lee's on. So Monroe Anderson and Jason Lee will be here when we return. Anderson has joined us, so skillful, so nimble with the computer. Just, we have a new system today, ladies and gentlemen. As I said already, Dr. D, Dennis, taking a much-deserved, much-needed day off. DJ Nate sitting in firm. So we have a new system. I thought it might rattle Monroe Anderson, but the pride and joy of Gary, Indiana, does not rattle easy, and he handled it. Like I said, I thought it was Mark Zuckerberg dealing with this internet. So, Monroe, welcome back to the show.
I have a son who's a computer engineer. So it's the genes have rubbed off on me.
If I had the money, I would hire that kid in an instant. But this kid, he makes more money than me and Monroe put together.
For sure.
So he's well beyond. But that kid is a genius. Well, he has two sons who are geniuses. But we'll hold off on extolling the virtues of Monroe's sons. So much to talk about, Monroe. I opened with my riff, paying homage to Ryan Murphy, the first episode of Impeachment. And I know you didn't feel as strongly about it as I did that first episode. You were a little bored by it. But I got to tell you, Monroe Anderson, I feel, get your thoughts on this in the most general way, that the Bill Clinton Monica Lewinsky debacle and everything that came from it and leading up to the impeachment is such a, is so relevant today on so many different levels that I find it rewarding in a sense to watch Ryan Murphy's dramatic reenactment. It just explores the deviousness of Democratic politicians like Bill Clinton and the deviousness, utter, diabolical, dark and dirty Republican tactics that are still at play by the Republican Party, who pretend that they're upholding all these great truths when they're trying just to exploit stuff to get political advantage. That's how I view it. How do you view it?
I view it pretty much the same, except we've had Trump. And therefore, anything that Clinton did, anything that the Democrats did, is junior varsity compared to what's going on now. And so, you know, so reliving this is sort of like going to a high school championship right when the NBA playoffs are in process.
That's actually pretty good, man. You could watch LeBron James of right. dishonesty and deviousness, Donald Trump, or you could watch the, you know, who's like a high school player that everybody would know. Yeah, you know, the JV version with Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton.
You're right.
Oh, you mean high school. Oh, we don't know, right? Exactly. We don't know who would be the JV version of basketball.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, I know a lot of great high school players, but I don't want to put their names out there and say they're as sleazy as Clinton. Clinton.
No, I'm talking about in comparison of.
Yes, no, I understand. Yeah.
Not sleazy. I mean, although Clinton was sleazy, I don't want to rob him of that. He was sleazy.
No, you don't want to take that away from Billy C. And
you know, Vernon,
in the first episode, he only comes in at the very end of the first episode. Which builds, I urge everybody, to, if you're a political junkie, you should watch it. You should just watch it, just have an opinion about it. But the first episode really sets it up, Monroe, for the tactics that the Republicans follow, because they make it very clear that their whole plan in using the sexual escapades of Clinton, that Clinton was keeping secret, but it was like an open secret, their whole plan is to get a lawsuit filed in which Bill Clinton will have to testify. And then once he testifies, they just know he's going to lie, because Bill Clinton can't help but lie every time he opens his mouth, and then they can nail him. And they make that clear that this was like in a chess match. That's what they were trying to do from the get-go.
Yeah, well, depends on what your definition of the is.
Yeah, what was that response? Did you have sex with him?
Yeah, right. With that woman.
Yeah. So anyway, know, but I by the way, that said, and
I may have said this on one of your shows a long time ago, but I was told by this kid who was working to get marijuana legalized in Illinois. This was 20 some years ago. But he told me that his boss had been at Oxford when Clinton was there. And Clinton was known for being very fond of marijuana brownies. And so when he's asked about marijuana, he said he had tried it, but he didn't inhale. And so that was technically true. He didn't inhale. He gobbled. He digested.
He gobbled. No, but Monroe, that I've forgotten that one. I didn't inhale. And that is classic Clinton. So full of it. Instead of just saying, yeah, I tried it, yeah, and I've quit. But of course, he can't say that because he's leading the war on drugs, where like thousands and thousands of black people are getting thrown into jail
right.
for doing what he did. So he can't say that. So he has to pretend he never did it with this like little sleazy walking nuanced walk the line. Well, you know, technically what I'm saying is true. Yeah, I am.
Oh, that's a pretty good Clinton imitation.
Thank you. what can I say? All right, we'll have plenty of time to talk about Bill Clinton in the weeks to come, because I know that show is it's 10 parts, and I know Monroe is a junkie like me. He'll be watching it. Let's talk about California for a moment. And we took the deep dive yesterday with a political activist, Bruce Williams from California, who's predicting that the Dems will prevail in the recall election. He says polls are already showing that that's the case, that Dems are getting their message out. I hope he's correct. I hope this Republican tactic doesn't work, even though I'm no fan of Governor Gavin Newsom, that's for certain. But one thing I need your opinion on, and I took the deep dive this week, and I told you this yesterday, Larry Elder, who, if the Republicans prevail, will probably be the next governor of California. Monroe, this man is out of his freaking mind. I watched him over the weekend, watched a little too much of him, I got to tell you. Your thoughts on Larry Elder and what he represents?
Well, he represents self-hatred. As a black person speaking and working against the interests of black people, he's an opportunist. He's a little on the wacko side, and he has about as good a chance of becoming governor of California as I do. And I don't live there. I live in Chicago.
So you don't think, well, first of all, I disagree with that last point. He may not have a great chance of becoming governor of California. He's got about a better chance than you, because at least he's on the ballot. You're not on the ballot. Right. So there's no chance of you getting elected.
Right.
So you just don't think the recall will prevail.
Yeah, that Dan Rather line, he got his chances are slim to none, and Slim just left town. So, I mean, the ballots that have already been cast are running very positive for Newsom. Two to one. And so he has a lead already. And now he started spending his war chest to tell Californians, don't do it. And, you know, one of the things that they're pointing out in this war chest is that Dianne Feinstein, who's the state senator, one of the state senators in Washington, has Alzheimer's or dementia or something. And so she is not functioning as well as she did years ago. And she's also elderly. And so should she die and we have a Governor Elder, he's already said that he's going to appoint a Republican, period. So that changes the dynamics in Washington. As you and I both know, the Democrats are pretty sheepish and ineffectual with a 50-50 vice president advantage. And so if the Republicans get a Republican senator, another Republican senator, I think job one for them is going to be to impeach Biden. And all the rest of the jobs are going to be to stop any progressive notion we thought we had and load up the courts with more right-wing judges.
Yeah, that's absolutely so. That just heightens the stakes, so to speak, with that recall. And as I said, Bruce Williams says the message is starting to get through and that people have figured out, or Dems have figured out, that a no vote is actually the one that they should make. And what Monroe was alluding to is the fact that voting by mail, the early voting by mail ballots are coming in from Democratic areas. And so this, we're going to be talking about this with Jason Lee in a little while. Monroe, Jason Lee, political strategist, will be joining us shortly from Texas. But this is compounding the advantage that the Democrats had in the 2020 election with vote by mail. The Republicans, they're sticking to the Donald Trump playbook about vote by mail, where you profess that it's illegal and it's corrupt and it's what contributed to the theft, and I have that in quotes because it's a freaking lie, of the election in 2020. And so they're not emphasizing it, which I think is a huge mistake on the part of Republicans. Not that I care about Republicans' mistakes, but that's what's happening in California as well. And so what the Republicans are hoping is that there is a massive turnout at the polls. Jason Lee has joined us. I'll finish up with Monroe briefly with this question, then we'll bring Jason into the conversation. But Monroe, the Republicans are clearly hoping that there is a massive turnout on Election Day in California to offset the gains, the advantages that the Democrats have with absentee ballots. Your thoughts about that Republican strategy?
It's not going to work. You know, it's a Hail Mary on their behalf. This is what's happening. The Republicans don't have anything positive in their policies. I mean, they're just running a negative and a lying and cheating campaign of all sorts, campaigns of all sorts, all across the country, because they don't have anything that is appealing to the modern American voter. And so they're desperate, and they're what they're doing is stacking the deck. That's the best they can do, because they have no message that's good for America. None. So,
well, the only message that they really have in California, and I don't think it'll prevail, but the only message is that the Democrats are hypocrites. The Democrats prescribe masks and social distancing for other people and don't abide by it themselves. So they're trying to take advantage of the attitude. The governor,
the big screw up. I mean, see, the problem the Republicans have is Trump. I don't care what a Democrat does, how hypocrite or anything, they're following Trump and all the things Trump did. Anything anybody else can do, Trump has done worse.
All right, let's bring Jason Lee in, a political strategist. Jason Lee joins us, seems like every other month. He is our man in Texas, born and raised in Texas, does works campaigns in Texas. And then I guess dealing with Texas politics wasn't bad enough. He decided to come to Chicago and get a little expertise in Chicago politics. So he's probably the only person in America, Monroe, who can answer this question. Which state is sleazier when it comes to politics, Illinois or Texas? And with that as an introduction, welcome back, Jason Lee.
Thanks, Ben. Good to see you, Monroe. Sleazier, I'd have to say Illinois. If you define sleazy as kind of what we tend to think in political terms, corruption, criminality amongst elected officials, different kinds of fraud. But obviously, if you look at, from a policy perspective, policies that make you feel sleazy, obviously Texas is at the top of that list right now, particularly.
All right, let's take the deep dive with Texas. Jason, the last time you were on the show, we analyzed their election bill. And at the time, it hadn't passed because the Democratic legislators, had fled the state of Texas. They were in Washington. They were all over the country. That was the last time you were on the show. Subsequently, the Dems returned and the bill passed along with the infamous abortion bill. We'll get to the abortion bill later. Let's start with the election law bill. So what are, again, the consequences of that election law bill, and how are they playing out so far in Texas?
Well, I'll start with the second part. The way it's playing out is that as soon as the governor signed the bill, which was yesterday, multiple lawsuits were filed against the legislation in federal court, and the Department of Justice also insinuated that they would be looking into the legislation. So it did trigger an immediate litigative response, which is to be expected and good. Obviously, with the Supreme Court that we have and some of the previous rulings they've made on election laws, like for Arizona, we only have so much confidence that will be the remedy. The other thing that happened was there was a renewed, you know, call for federal legislation. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act has passed the House and is awaiting a vote in the Senate. That will restore Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which would allow all of these bills to go through pre-clearance. And this Texas bill might have been eliminated before it even got off the ground, if preclearance was still the law of the land. The bill, it empowers, poll watchers to potentially do voter intimidation. It eliminates some of the voting expansions that were implemented in response to COVID. It makes it more difficult to vote by mail. And a couple other things that added all together, put more pressure on people's access to voting. Texas already had some of the tougher voting laws in the state. And in fact, as someone who didn't live in the state and tried to vote absentee, there were several elections where I found it easier to actually fly back to state and vote than try to figure out how I was going to get an absentee ballot in. So it's already somewhat difficult, and this makes it more difficult. And groups are trying to activate and figure out how they can, assuming that the litigation, regardless of the litigation, we need to get folks registered. We need to get them out to vote and figuring out strategies to do so.
Wow. The part of the bill I guess the whole bill disturbs me, but that part that you alluded to, Jason, where it empowers poll watchers to intimidate voters. This has relations, of course, to the abortion bill. But talk a little bit about that. What do you think the consequences of empowering poll watchers will be? Do you think there'll be actually instances where MAGA poll watchers go into election booths?
No, they won't. They aren't allowed in election booths. They aren't allowed in election booths. Obviously, they're not allowed in the voting facility. They're allowed, at some distance or some near proximity. There already was a provision where you can go in and get certain counts periodically. But this basically, what this did was it kind of the election judge who operated the polling location used to have broad discretion to basically get rid of these people. And now that discretion is taken away. So people will be able to, do things without being, as long as they don't theoretically go too far. So it's hard to know how it will play out. I'm sure there'll be instances where people do show up and they're kind of standing there with a sign or something. I don't know what they think they're looking for. My fear is that there will be instances that are more confrontational. And because this is Texas, it is not the case that you're going to see sectional intimidation, like people in rural areas coming with guns. Unfortunately, in Texas, everyone has guns. So no matter, it'll be more of a standoff situation, I fear, than a kind of intimidation. And I just don't want to see that, turn into something really catastrophic. So that's part of my fear, is just the general ratcheting up. Because at the same time, on September 1, there was another law in Texas that went in, which is the permitless carry. So now you can carry a gun without a permit. And so if you add those two things up, there's definitely some cause for concern.
Wait a minute. So just, I wasn't prepared to talk about this, but you just threw it out there. I'm looking at Monroe like, did you hear about this?
Oh, yeah.
Permitless carry.
Right.
Texas exactly. Is insane, Jason Lee. You know what? Illinois may be sleazier than Texas, and I'm still not conceding that.
Right.
But definitely Texas is more insane than a permitless carry.
Right.
In other words, you can just put the gun in. You don't have to.
Back in the days.
You have to have a permit to get the gun.
Right. Back in the days of the Wild Wild West, when you went into a bar, you had to check your gun. at the door. They pick it up or something. And they don't even have that now.
There will still be some, private businesses and other places, I think, are allowed to have prohibitions. The enforcement mechanism is not clear on that. What's happening in Texas is that Texas is at the vanguard right now, obviously, of a kind of proactive conservative movement, right? So if you look at all of these laws, they're not really Texas innovations. They're laws that have been percolating around the conservative activist base, the permitless carry, the abortion laws. These are all laws that are percolating around these different interest groups. And the Texas Republicans and the governor decided that they want to be the ones to finally take some of these ideas that have been percolating and push them as far as they can, because it's Texas, because they're, the vanguard of the movement. And then that will inspire all these other states to then follow suit. But they want to move from kind of the middle of the conservative movement to the vanguard of it. And that's what you're seeing particularly in the last legislative sessions.
Yeah, but it has Abbott's ratings dropped to 42 or something like that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Right. So what the ironies of this is, as the Republican conservative movement is decided to kind of assume their position at the vanguard of the national conservative movement, the state is trending in the opposite direction. Hillary Clinton lost Texas by 9%. Joe Biden only lost it by 5.5%. The census report shows that urban areas are growing at the expense of rural areas. The state is becoming more diverse. And so when you do the polling, a lot of the governor's policies are unpopular with the statewide electorate. He's at 50% disapproval, well, 41% approval. That's the lowest he's ever been. The problem is, if you look at where he is in the Republican electorate, all of those policies are very popular. And right now his focus is on, one, establishing himself again as the head of the lead of the national conservative movement with an eye toward 2024. And secondly, to make sure that he has no problems in the Republican primary. I assume his strategy is that by the time you get to the general election, a couple of things will be the case. One, Democrats will not have been able to produce an acceptable candidate. Two, people will have forgotten, or the temperature would have been lowered on a lot of these policies that are happening now, and people would have kind of settled back down. Three, you're benefiting from just your usual fact that in a Democratic presidential midterm year, you expect the Republicans to do better. And four, because of his fundraising prowess, he's going to have probably $120, $150 million. And he thinks that'll be able to, suppress whatever challenge arises.
Of course, now the problem with that thinking is that you have another Republican governor with the same plot, and that's DeSantis in Florida. So by the time we get to 2024, you're going to at least have two crazy men who have given their soul to the devil and are following a death series with how they're handling the virus and other things. And so even if they both are popular, they're going to cancel each other out. But I think both of them are going to be out of contention by the time we get there, because they both have low ratings. And if the Democrats can get their stuff together and actually pass some of this pending legislation, they're going to be very popular next year and in 2024.
Jason, what's your thoughts about that?
I've embarrassed myself so many times in recent years to be in the, so I opted out of the prediction business. I'm still in the analysis business, but I think Monroe raises some good points and some good and definitely some potentialities. And by 2024, you know, there could be headwinds. Like you said, if the Democrats' agenda is not only passed, but by then actually showing some dividends in people's lives, you know, it may end up being a moot point. But, you know, again, like, it's hard for me to put anything past these guys, because, you know, we've seen crazy things happen, you know, and unfortunately, it's not always linear. You know, it's not always linear between policy and politics, right? And that creates a challenge.
But first of all, I think the Republicans are in the process of jumping the shark. They're in such bad shape, so I think the Democrats are going to have so much ammunition to use against them. You know, because with the abortion laws that the Republicans are pushing through, and with Texas leading that, of course, Black women have already been solidly against the Republicans. And now suburban white women, their numbers are growing because the vast majority of women, even those who don't believe in choice, don't like the idea that if they were raped, they'd have to bear the child of the rapist.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly true. This could definitely rankle a number of people that the Republicans have historically counted on, suburban women being first on that list.
All right. You said, Jason, something, and I wrote it down. You said, it's not always linear between policies and politics. And right now, the law passed in Texas, signed by the governor, effectively outlaws abortion, bans abortion, and criminalizes abortions and that take place after 6 weeks. They deputize people. Monroe and I have talked. We talked about this a lot on the show with a lot of different people. They've deputized ordinary citizens to file lawsuits if they feel they have evidence of anybody who's contributed to a woman getting an abortion. You could sue the doctor, you could sue who does the abortion, you could sue the Uber driver who drives a woman to the abortion, you could sue the friend who accompanies the woman to the abortion, et cetera, and so forth. They exempt the woman. They think that's going to help them with those suburban women, I guess, by exempting the woman from punishment in this particular instance. So that's the policy that's just been enacted. That's where Texas is at right now. In your opinion, Jason, how will that play out politically in the state of Texas?
Yeah, it's hard to say, man. I mean, you know, abortion is one of those highly polarized issues where you've got, you know, a group of people who are extremely, you know, pro-choice, and another group who are extremely anti-abortion, and both are passionate and active. And then you've got a lot of people in the middle who feel a certain kind of way, but far less motivated by that particular issue. They would rank it lower. You know, if you think about Texas, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but, you know, most of people, if you know the name Wendy Davis, right, which was a state senator in Texas who did a filibuster to stop an abortion law in Texas in 2014. Well, when she did that, there was about 40 abortion clinics in Texas before this bill was was enacted. The most recent one, there were only 15 abortion clinics left in the state, and so you've already seen in the last 6 years a dramatic reduction in access to abortion, and that has coincided with some Democratic gains, right? For several issues, for several reasons, particularly in large counties. It's also coincided at the statewide level with a shrinkage of Republican vote margin. But they've still been winning, and it's not clear that has been the primary issue in any of those elections. So you know, you can make arguments on both sides as to how this will ultimately impact them in the state. Again, like Texas has a growing minority population, mostly Latinos. Their attitudes on abortion are different, I think, than just your standard, you know, Democratic voter. You know, there's some wiggle room, I think, that they have on this that they might not have in certain other states. So, and again, the Latino pop, they're it's not just that the Latino, but they're also, you know, conservative Latino populations in the state, particularly in the Valley. So you just have, you have some opportunities and some windows, and there are other issues that, frankly, are more, at least according to polling, are more prevalent, and they're going to try to focus there. Like, they still have an advantage on border issues. They still think they have an advantage on crime. Like, their mission is to shift the, make sure that the election focuses on the terrain in which they're strong.
Yeah, except the problem is with this abortion bill and the fact that you can now have bounty hunters tracking down people. Nobody likes that. Let me start again. Most voters don't like the idea that you have no skin in the game, but you can make some money off of tracking somebody down and dragging them into court. A lot of Republicans are worried about this nationwide. And there's this realization that if this practice stands, then what Democrats say in New York could do is use the same tactic on gun owners. But if they don't have a license, or if they bought the gun from some gun dealer or whatever, then we could put a bounty on that. So it could turn into a very nasty tit for tat nationwide if this concept is allowed to exist.
Yeah, I mean, it could.
A very tricky time.
It definitely could, and you know, it would be interesting if they did look at something
and
like
should
that.
And should, yeah, right,
but. But you know, it was a clever design of a policy that ultimately, you know, it worked as they wanted it to, because the Supreme Court refused to stay it, and it wasn't that the police it worked how they wanted, because it wasn't that the court was saying that this invalidates Roe. The court was saying that based on the way this law is structured, we don't have jurisdiction, and that's exactly what they were trying to do by taking it from government enforcement to civil enforcement.
Yeah, right, exactly. But the problem is, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And so we can do the same. I mean, progressives could do the same with our issues. And the other part of this is the KKK clause law with bounty hunters tracking down people that can be put into place. I mean, there are some protections, but the thing is, the Democrats have to be a lot more aggressive than they've been. You know, they're still doing too much hand wringing. They're not acting like they are in charge, and they should be in charge.
Well, this is one of my favorite themes in general, Monroe, that I'm going to pick up on and kick it to Jason on this. And my sense from afar about Texas Democrats statewide, Jason, and feel free to disagree with me if you do, they're so cautious. And they try to present themselves as the reasonable alternative to Republican outrageousness. I'm thinking about Beto O'Rourke's campaign. His Texas senatorial campaign, as opposed to his presidential campaign, when he got so desperate, he said he was going to go take your guns, which was sort of taking an extreme point of view, to put it mildly. And I always get the feeling that that Democrats running in Texas have subscribed to the Barack Obama Bill Clinton, Rahm Emanuel playbook that you don't, there's like a center that you can appeal to. And the left will just go along because they have no choice. But if you can win that center over by being reasonable and even criticizing the left flank, you will prevail in elections. I can't remember where that's ever worked in the state of Texas, that particular attitude. So please address that, Jason. Am I wrong? Am I being unfair to Texas Democrats by linking this tactic to them?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the problem with the Democratic Party in Texas is that it's structural. It's just like infrastructure, money, just like institutions, like they atrophy, right? Like we talked about this before, which is that when, you know, look, the South, since the Civil Rights Movement, the South has been like moving Republican. Like LBJ said it, that was just like fait accompli, but like it didn't happen like immediately in terms of a full sweep. Like there was like a 30-year period where like the Republicans had to like come, right? We, you know, Texas last Democratic governor was in lost to George Bush in 1994, right? It wasn't like 1968, right? So like we had Democratic governors, we had Democratic statewide electeds, and even the lieutenant governor under George W. Bush was a Democrat. The thing is that the Republicans, you know, we had Bush style Republicans. You know, we had these kind of, you know, good old boy, they weren't super partisan. They were about money and business and kind of on certain cultural things, they were seen more moderate than the average Republican, right? Compassionate conservative was George W. Bush's deal. And that doesn't mean they weren't doing things that were bad, but they had a different style. And because of that, once they took power, there wasn't the same energy and motivation within the different Democratic infrastructure to say, we got to stop these guys. We got to fight these guys. It was like, well, it's going to be too hard to fight them and we can work with them, right? They're still like we're sharing power to a certain extent, even in state government. I never forget when George Bush ran for president, there was a group of Texas Democrats who actually went to the Republican National Committee to defend George Bush from attacks about Texas because they had been working with him so closely. So anyway, I digress. But the point of the matter is, to me, the problem is like the infrastructure that you would have in a party to really like try to compete for power atrophied because folks thought things were kind of okay. And then when the Republican Party made this dramatic shift, you're in a position where like now it's not okay, but you're nowhere near where you have to be to challenge it like electorally. In terms of the tactics you're referring to, because the infrastructure is not there, most of what happens is like there's no strategic around like who's running and what they're saying. It's like whoever wants to run runs, and whatever they want to say, they say. Like it's not like it really has to do with whatever individual decides to do whatever they're going to do, as opposed to some tactic. Now there are different factions who think one way or the other, but like none of those factions have enough strength to really shape what the message is or dictate any of that stuff. And if you're going to do anything, you're going to have to get everybody anyway. So you're not going to really be trying to polarize one Dem against the other. You're just going to be trying to pick a set of messaging that you think is viable. So it's more so just, we're not even at the point where those conversations really matter as much like they do in Illinois, and you've got progressives and other people always fighting. In Texas, like there's rudimentary things we need to figure out first before we're going to do this.
Well, yeah. Well, what happened 30 years ago or so was that the Koch brothers and others figured out that, while everybody was fighting over who should be in Washington, they went to these small towns and counties from state to state and started investing in right-wing candidates. And so they control all these various state houses now as a result of that strategy. And what's happening now, which is really interesting, is Steve Bannon wrote this email that's been passed around nationwide that what Republicans should be doing now is running for everything from dog catcher to state legislator. They should register as being at the voting booths as a judge. they should be controlling all these things. And so there's been this incredible increase in people running for Republicans, right-wing Republicans, running for very small positions so they can control it from the grassroots up. And I don't think Democrats are paying enough attention to this right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
What's your sense of how Democrats are doing on that front in Texas?
I mean, the issue is like, it's polarized, right? So Democrats control large counties, cities. The Republicans control everything else. And you haven't yet got to a point where there's enough, like you're moving in that direction, but the population and the vote stuff is still somewhat skewed towards the rural. And yeah, I would agree that those folks have become more radicalized, that some of those folks on the ground have become more conservative. The national conservative movement has probably been more effective at really focusing like through the party apparatus. Because again, a lot of this down ballot stuff is officially nonpartisan, right? But the Republican Party has still decided that even though it's technically nonpartisan, we're going to focus on it and do it as a way of making sure that that we can anchor these spaces, you know, because they're looking ahead. You know, part of the though, like, and I always say this because people give the Republicans, I think, a lot more credit than deserve. Part of the problem is that the Republicans have a very limited agenda. Like, they don't have a lot of other things to worry about but the means and processes of like control, like taking power and holding it, because there's nothing else. They just want it for its sake in order to be a bulwark against the stuff. And then there's a few activist Republican things that will try to move some stuff back and like push progress back. But for the most part, like if Mitch McConnell takes the Senate, like he doesn't want to achieve anything. He wants to put some judges in, maybe cut someone's taxes, and that's it. If you stop him to do anything else, he doesn't care. He didn't care to begin with. Whereas Democrats are trying to do politics, but also everything else. Govern, pass all these laws. I work with, you know, local Democratic leaders, like the person who runs Harris County, which is the largest county in Texas, right? Like, her days are consumed with trying to like do policies that help people and new initiatives and how do we keep people in their housing and what are we doing on COVID and what's this other The time left over to plot and strategize and plan like the statewide political strategy, which ostensibly like this person might be the one you might expect to do it. Like in some ways you could argue, you know, she's the most powerful Democratic elected in the state running the largest county, like is not there. Right. You know what I'm saying? And it makes it harder. You know, it's just a structural disadvantage is that when you're actually trying to achieve things, it can become more difficult to focus on all these kind of things that are not about really achieving anything, but just the pure consolidation of power. And, you know, I want to say this carefully because I think it might be overstated, but like the example I would compare it to is like, if you look at, you know, Mike Madigan for many years, he was very much focused on the maintenance of power and he was excellent at that, right? He was singularly focused. The critique was, okay, you have the power, but what are we actually advancing and doing? Right. And sometimes there's a tension between that singular maintenance and building of power and the actual wielding of it. And sometimes those things can be in conflict.
Yeah. And but going back to the Bannon email that he sent out to everyone that has gone viral. One of the things he told them was that you have to run for election judges. Make yourself a candidate. And so next year, you're going to have a lot of MAGA types as judges in these swing states who get to make calls that are not going to be balanced or nonpartisan. And, you know, we're just now becoming aware of it. And I don't know what the solution to that is, except to make sure that our people also become judges, more of them.
I think part of the reason Republicans are doing that is because our folks have actually historically been disproportionately the judges for all kinds of reasons. you know, the judges get paid a little bit of money. You know, we have like some low income folks who tend to be, you know, do that kind of work, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what Bannon is trying to do, on at least on that free point, is try to catch up, because it's historically, I think if you were to poll, I think election workers, I think it would probably skew Democratic until obviously this concerted effort.
Yeah. But the difference is, being Democrats, there was a tendency to be more fair.
For sure. For sure.
And Republicans are not going to do that. Yeah. That's not what they're going to show up at the party.
Yeah. And it's structural, right? Because it's like, again, it's like, you can't, for example, like, we have, so like Republicans, like if Republicans get power, it's a guarantee that they're going to gerrymander lines when they have redistricting, right? Like, it's a guarantee. The only time Republicans will call for something like fair maps is in a situation where they think they can't get power, so it's like the next best alternative to take the power from Democrats. Meanwhile, we have Democrats who will advocate for a fair map or independent commission even when Democrats are in power, right? Because they believe that that is fundamentally fair and that's the right thing to do. But those are our voters. Those are the people who contribute money. Like, you know, those are people who are part of the party. So it's like hard to say, well, we should just, yeah, you know, we should be ruthless, but we've got a percentage of our party that we need to win who actually doesn't want that kind of politics. I mean, to go back to the Madigan example, like, he was very effective at wielding power, but he still had so many Democrats who didn't like the way he operated, even though that he was effective. If that had been a Republican, you probably wouldn't have heard any Republican criticism as long as he was delivering the goods of the elections, et cetera, right? I mean, it's just a completely different election base that we can't win without, because if we lose all those people, we're going to lose anyway. You know, we can't just alienate them because they're such a big part of our base. And I don't know how you deal with that just structural difference between the bases of the two parties.
All right, now I got to jump in here. I do not know. I can't speak for Texas, Jason, because I don't. All I know about Texas is what I read in the newspaper. But the number of people in the state of Illinois who jumped aboard the Fair Maps bandwagon, and I'm talking about Dems, I call them Dems, or reformers, or good government types. Some of Monroe's best friends are in this group, but I'm not going to name any names. These good reformer Dem types, I don't believe they make up the base of the Democratic Party. I believe they're wealthier. I believe they contribute to Democratic candidates. You're absolutely correct. I believe they're one of the few people that bother to read an editorial that the Tribune or the Sun-Times might write. I know I'm usually the only one who ever reads those editorials. And as such, they have a far greater voice in the mainstream media than their actual numbers. But I don't think any Democrat, you put it to a Democrat in Illinois, oh, can we screw them before they screw us? And Dems will say, yeah, screw them. Now, but Jason, this is something that popped up. I've just watching in Illinois unfold, and love to get your comments and Monroe's comments too, because Monroe's been around Chicago a long time. Not only are the Dems in Illinois getting attacked from the Fair Map crowd, which who cares what they say anyway, and from Republicans, but they've also, they're going to be sued by black plaintiffs and Latino plaintiffs on the grounds that the legislative maps that the Dems have adopted and that Pritzker has signed do not set up enough majority black and majority Latino districts. Now here, now we're getting into a conflict, a profound conflict that the Democratic Party faces, Jason and Monroe, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Traditionally, to get a black candidate elected in Chicago or Illinois, you had to have a more or less what they call a supermajority district, where lots of black people packed into one district. That's the only way it's going to happen. That actually, when you do that, it may benefit this or that black politician, but it also benefits the Republicans because it's packing black people into one district, and that minimizes their statewide power, if you follow what I'm saying. So this is a conflict that the Democrats are facing. What's your thoughts on this, Jason and Monroe? Are you with the plaintiffs who file the suit and want more black majority, super majority districts?
It's hard for me to say because I haven't seen the map or, you know, what particular grievance that they have with the map itself and where they're thinking that that district needs to be, right? So it just kind of depends on, to me, it would just depend on the particularities, right, of this specific map. Because in general, like, this is a complicated issue. And, you know, there's always been tension, you know, on this and going back from the Voting Rights Act itself and how to think about, you know, the best way to do that. So I think there are arguments that make sense on both sides. But I personally, the way I would assess it is just on a case by case basis. I think there are some scenarios where it makes sense to try to increase minority representation. I think there are other scenarios where it's probably not a good idea based on what you would have to do in order to create it.
Monroe, your thoughts.
There is a theory that's taking root right now that the Republicans, in their gerrymandering and setting up these concentrated MAGA districts, may lose out next year and in 2024 because their votes are so concentrated, and with all the crazy stuff going on in the Republican Party, that the folks that aren't in those concentrated MAGA districts are going to be rebelling against the Republicans and what they have done and are doing. So it'll be interesting to see if that comes to fruition or not. Right now, it's an interesting theory, but we haven't seen it play out. So we'll see next year and 3 years from now.
Well, I could tell you this. There's probably to be more Democratic infighting than there will be Republican infighting. That is for sure, for all these reasons. And Jason, I just have to say one thing. I was taking notes on your riff on Michael Joseph Madigan, and you're absolutely correct. There was no policy. There was no ideology. There was no adherence to larger Democratic goals, initiatives with Michael Joseph Madigan. It was all about power and reelecting his caucus members and holding on to the speakership. And I know so many activists who've told me so many off the record stories down through the years about dealing with Madigan and how he tormented them and sort of tortured them, if you will. Delaying even introducing one of their bills or holding back votes on it and just keeping the game going for them, making them come back to him time and time again. The most obvious example is gay marriage. I don't know if you were in the state for that, Jason Monroe, you probably remember this, where Michael Joseph Madigan wouldn't have the vote. He had Greg Harris, the sponsor of the bill, pull the measure from the House floor because he said the time wasn't right to call a vote. And you know what he did for that? When he did that, Jason, he brought everybody back for one more year. And that was another year of fundraising. I said, the man is no dope and no fool, Jason Lee. He's not dedicated to gay marriage. He's dedicated to Michael Joseph Madigan power. And then yet, when the gay marriage bill was passed, all the supporters go, thank you, Michael Joseph Madigan. Yeah, man. So, all right, Jason, no ducking and dodging on this one. I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this, so this is a sneak question. Monroe's smiling because he knows what it is. Last week, we had a fierce debate on our show on this day. Delmarie Cabb, political activist Norman Solomon, political activists from California who are leading the charge against Rahm Emanuel being approved as ambassador to Japan, came on the show. And it was a battle. Monroe was standing strong, not so much for Rahm, but saying it's not a fight worth for Democrats worth having. Delmarie was having none of that. So it was a fascinating little back and forth. I, of course, am rooting like hell for Dems to vote against Rahm. What is your thoughts on this matter, Jason Lee?
I think I agreed with Monroe last time, and I think I'm going to agree with him again here. You know, it's funny because I worked in Chicago. I've worked with the teachers union intimately. I worked, you know, involved in the campaign against Rahm and his allies in 2015. And, you know, I was on the other side, you know, of him, at least politically at a certain level, a lot, in my time in Chicago. But when he decided not to run again, like, I never even for a second imagined that he was somehow going to be diminished in the Democratic Party. I totally imagined that he would return to a kind of like senior, leadership kind of role within the party, that people would still go to him for advice, that he would still be an influential player at the highest levels. And that he would still maybe even be tapped for roles. You know, I mean, there was really no breach. You know, he immediately went from like Chicago to being a talking head on ABC. And like I knew he was talking to Kamala Harris's campaign, Biden, you know, so like, I feel like that ship had sailed to me. So like whatever he ended up getting, like, was just faded, you know, it was whatever. Like, I have, you know, like, problems with Rahm, particularly as his leadership of Chicago, but like, that doesn't mean that Rahm has like no value or no, like, he has some skills, like, he is good at certain things. So if there's some role they feel like they can use him for, I'm not really too upset about it. You know, I don't want him to be mayor of Chicago again, to say the least, but, you know, he can do something. Right. He can do something for his country, you know, for Joe Biden. And, you know, I just don't have the wherewithal to be overly concerned, especially given all the other problems we're facing.
Right. No, Jason, my position was that he's not the mayor of Chicago anymore. So he got his just due. That's what he really wanted to be, besides president, of course, which he won't get either. But he's out of the office. So if he's made an ambassador to Japan or Taiwan or Jamaica or whatever, it does not matter. That's not a great big deal. And I don't think it's worth being a distraction, his position being a distraction to all the crises that Biden is facing right now. This should not be a fight over whether Rahm should go to Japan or not. Should not be one of those fights.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Well, outnumbered on my own show. How about that? Outnumbered on my own show. God damn. Last week it was a different story, Jason Lee. I'm just going to tell you, Delmarie Cobb was very passionate about Monroe's. You got to see the smile on Monroe's face, ladies and gentlemen. Monroe Anderson and I will be 152 years old in a senior citizen home arguing this point, Jason Lee. We'll be arguing about Rahm in Chicago and whether Democrats should go after him. And anytime someone like some aide in the nursing home comes to give us our juice for the day, comes by and says, "Oh, I'm with Monroe on that," he have this huge smile on his face. I told you. All right, now I'm going to drag Jason into this other one and see what he has to say about this. But he knows this one's coming, so we'll close it with this one. I'm obsessively following the impeachment show on FX TV, Ryan Murphy's dramatic account of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky leading to the impeachment of Bill Clinton in the 1990s. I subscribe to the theory that Bill Clinton has become a caricature of an insincere Democratic politician who lies all the time and can't be trusted, and as such has become an effective punching bag for the Republican Party, to the point where Donald Trump can lie at will and nobody holds him accountable on the grounds that, oh, Clinton did it. Clinton lied. You didn't care when Clinton lied. So that is my attitude about Bill Clinton and the role he has played and the role he continues to play, or politicians like him play. What's your thoughts on this, Jason? Do you think I'm exaggerating Bill Clinton's detriment to the Democratic Party and to politics in general?
Yeah, I mean, to me, like, Bill Clinton is you know, he's kind of, he's like the quintessential, you know, man of his era to a certain extent. And he had great personal gifts and severe personal weaknesses. And that to me is kind of the story of Bill Clinton. But I see him as more of a, he was the conduit for a type of politics that was already, you know, fomenting and growing within the Democratic Party in response to, you know, backlash and, or response to basically, you know, marginalization, you know, by the Reagan administration and the concern about, you know, would Democrats be able to win nationally with the same set of politics carried over from the 70s and 80s. I think, like, you know, that was a question worth asking. There might have been a different way to go that still could have found a way back into power. But whoever had those alternative ideas clearly was not, you know, were not able to succeed, you know. And so sometimes, you know, that's the reality. So I can't like condemn him for succeeding. I definitely, there are things about him that I don't, you know, that he did that I don't agree with, but he was also in an era where politics was shifting and the rise of cable news, the rise of a certain kind of talk radio polarization. Like he had to deal with the coming together of that right wing kind of machine that Monroe was talking about and fully like realizing itself, like all that was coming to the fore and he had to be the person, you know, to kind of first face that down and try to deal with that. And that combined with some of his personal weaknesses created some challenges, but he had to stand in there and deal with it. And then, you know, I think like that was the kind of the thing that Obama learned was like, obviously Obama was a different case because he was also black, but you know, when Obama ran in 08, it was kind of like, look, you know, the Clinton politics was like too cynical. They were focused on triangulation. It was too polarized. Like they saw politics as a zero sum game. There's another way, right? There's no red states. There's no blue states. We can bring this country together or there's a higher calling. Da, da, da. And then he gets in there and it's like completely like the same, but worse. And he's like stymied at every cost and they're doing all this stuff. And it's just like, it may just be the case that like, this is just what it is now. Right. And it's just, it's toxic. It's ugly. And like that kind of, dream of what politics once was, you know, is not there. And so Clinton was kind of the first guy to really have to face that down, but I don't think he's necessarily the cause of it. Right. And so that's where I'm at. But like, I'm clearly willing to listen to critiques of the policies that he and others implemented and the outcomes, but I have a hard time assigning so much culpability to just him as an individual versus kind of the context in which he was in.
That's pretty well said. Monroe, do you agree with Jason on that?
Yeah. Yeah. He cut to the chase on it. And you know, but again, now and this is my being optimistic. I'm not making a prediction on this just yet, but I believe that the Republicans have just gone too far. And that they're going to pay the price next year and in 2024, big time. Because they are doing anything righteous. I mean, if you look at what's happening with the January 6th investigation and how they're handling it versus what the Democrats are doing, I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, 15 years ago, if I had written a novel with this plot, it wouldn't get published because they'd say it was too fanciful and unrealistic. So I think the Republicans, in their desperation and in their drive for power, are going to implode. They're imploding right now, but it's slow motion.
Well, I'd like to believe you're correct. We'll leave it here. And Jason, we'll be bringing you back to talk Texas because, to the point, have the Republicans gone too far? I'll close where we started. They've effectively outlawed abortion in the state of Texas.
Right.
Before they did that, I would have thought that's too far. politically speaking. Now, maybe Roe shielded people from having to deal with the consequences of such a law abolishing abortion, and now we're coming face to face with it, and we're going to come face to face with it throughout the country. I said this to Jason Monroe before we went on the air. I can't think of one red state in this country where a statewide official lost an election because he or she was against abortion. So it, as an issue, it has not really worked for Democrats in statewide races. It's worked for Democrats in congressional races. What's that?
Ben, what about Kentucky, where you have a Democratic governor right now in a very Republican state?
Well, there are Democratic governors, or have been Democratic governors in Republican states. Right now, Louisiana has a Democratic governor, and that's a Joe Manchin comes from West Virginia. He used to be the governor of West Virginia. That's a Republican state. So there are Democrats who get elected statewide, but I've never seen abortion, the issue of availability of abortion, as the driving force. If anything, Democrats in statewide elections, as we were talking about with Texas, move away from those contentious issues, those social issues like gun control or abortion rights, because they don't want to inflame the majority of voters. They want to just sort of convince them that I'm like you, just on the fringes, I'm a little different. So I'll be following this one, as will Jason, to see. I'm not making any predictions, Jason Lee, about Texas. I don't know enough about but I'm a big fan of Wendy Davis. I remember her campaign in 2014. When that failed, I was like, oh my goodness. But this is even beyond that. Don't you agree, Jason?
It's just hard to know. And you can't be a prisoner of the news cycle. Like, the election's a long way away. And so we'll have to see. And human agency matters. Like, it depends on what people do and how they organize and how they fight and how they're able to, you know, there's stuff that, like, it's not just, there's action and activity that dictates how these things play out. But Ben, before we go, I did want to flag one thing for Chicago listeners to look at, that's in the news, that may be hearing more about, you know, as it relates to the some of the, you know, we've been hearing about all this crime stuff, like you and I were talking about before, and it's just a drumbeat. There's a particular case that's going to be in the news around 2 7-year-olds. One was killed. One was injured. A 6-year-old was injured in a shooting, and there's now a major conflict between the police department and the state's attorney's office, because the state's attorney's office refused to accept the charges. And the police department is complaining and saying that they did all this work and that, you know, they built this case, and how dare the state's attorney not accept the charges. I just want to say it's completely bunk. And on this case, the state's attorney is 100% right. The state's attorney is not allowed to talk about these cases that are they receive. But I know, and don't ask me how I know, but I know for without a doubt that these cases that they're receiving are not at all able to be convicted. They're not, the basis of the cases are so weak. The key witnesses are, you know, refusing to cooperate. No physical evidence, no surveillance. You have multiple eyewitnesses, for example, and this is not specific, but I'm just telling you the type of stuff that happens in these cases. You'll have two eyewitnesses with competing descriptions of events, right? So they ask you what happened. You say what happened. Two people will say two different things. And then and neither one of them will be corroborated by other evidence. This is the kind of stuff that you can't convict on. What the police do is they say, well, this guy's a bad guy. Convict him. Well, that's not how the law works. And frankly, we don't want it to work that way. And the state's attorney has to stand up for both victims and the Constitution, right? And the state's attorney is getting bullied here because the state's attorney can't and is not going to go out and tell the public, look how bad, look at the terrible work that the detectives are doing. But in this particular case, the detective, when they went back to him and said, look, we don't have enough here, could you please keep trying? He said, I'm done with this. I want to see my family. I just forget about it. I don't want to do any more work on this. And in fact, the Area 5 detective begged the state's attorney to file charges, not because they had a case, but because he felt that morale was getting too low. that is not why charges get filed, is because police morale is too low. They need to revamp the detective department. They need to recommit themselves to cultivating confidential informants. And they need to, and then they frankly need to just focus on that and quit blaming the state's attorney for protecting the Constitution. We will not be trying to convict people based on the non-existence of evidence. So I'm asking all Chicagoans who keep hearing this time and time again of the police department blaming the state's attorney, that's not the issue. There are about 13,500 shootings. Police have only made arrests in about 2,000 of them. The majority of people who commit crimes are not because they were out on bail or the state's attorney didn't accept charges. It's because they're not getting caught. We need to catch people. We need to build good cases and convict them. And the police department has a role to play. And that's what I want to say, because unfortunately, the state's attorney's office is unable to say these things because of their role. But someone needs to, because this is getting ridiculous. And most importantly, it's warping Chicagoans thinking about criminal justice, and which is then reducing accountability on the police department. And there needs to be even more accountability, not just on, you know, reform, but on actually solving crimes. Because I think we had about 10 children shot this weekend. And for the life of me, Ben, I can't keep, you know, this is, we say it's unacceptable, but we don't mean that. I mean it. Like, we have to got to figure something out. And we can't just keep scapegoating.
Well, we got diverted with our talks in national politics. And I should just remind people that Jason's come on the show. We've talked about criminal justice issues. We talked about policing issues. We talked about crime as a political force. There's a very powerful article in today's Chicago Sun-Times. I urge everybody to read it. Jason alerted me to it. I read it and absorbed it. There's two cases right now. It's not just the case of the murder of the seven-year-old, which is just thinking of saying that, a murder of a seven-year-old. There was a murder of a four-year-old this weekend.
It's, wow. Yep.
We get numb when we think about it. But there's two cases right now. There's also a case of a man who, a 19-year-old who was in the National Guard. Very similar sort of tension between the police officers who think they have a case and they think they have a suspect that should be tried. And as Jason points out, the state's attorney says, you don't have the evidence we need to take this to court. I can't win a conviction with what you've given me. And so what's the point of having the case if the suspect is just going to walk in the end because we don't have strong evidence? And so, yeah, it's becoming a political issue. Ray Lopez, the alderman of the 15th Ward, is championing him. Gilbert Villegas, who's the alderman of the, I believe, do this off the top of my head, the 38th Ward, is taking the police side. I've not seen any aldermen who are championing Kim Fox right now on this particular issue, Jason. And Kim Fox has her own larger problems that have stemmed, oh my goodness, just going back to Justice Smollett. So she's playing defense on these things. And you're absolutely correct. If you don't have a case, you can't win before a jury. So I don't know. This is one, Jason Lee, where there are no easy answers, but really the police and the state's attorney, at the very least, have got to, sit down and work this out a little bit, because what as you pointed out, what was in the Sun Times were the police were trying to get charges filed without the state's attorneys signing on to it. The state's attorney essentially telling the police they've not done their job fully to get charges. The police saying morale is low, so let's charge. That's not acceptable. You got to be on the same team, so to speak. Jason Lee, and when they're fighting each other, I don't know how anyone can benefit from this. Go ahead.
You're exactly right. And I don't want to interrupt because I know we got to go, but you're exactly right. And again, like Ray Lopez and Alderman Lloyd Rogers and Villegas, they're listening to one side of the story, and the police are basically describing the evidence they have. But if you actually looked at what they had, I think even those guys would say, no, there's no way, right? Like when you say, all right, we had an eyewitness, right? That sounds impressive. But then you discover that the eyewitness is a 78-year-old person who was had a corner block away, and what they described was not actually what was seen on the limited surveillance tape. You can't go to trial with that witness. any defense attorney worth anything is that witness is getting you nowhere, right? Like, that's not, but what they'll say is, we had an eyewitness. You see what I'm saying? And so now Lopez and Villegas are saying, well, the police said they had an eyewitness. How are we not filing charges? The state's attorney can't come out and then say, well, this eyewitness was not reliable for XYZ, because they're not allowed to talk about the case like that. And that's the unfair aspect of this, is that there are elements of this that if people could talk about, they would see that, yeah, they're right. These cases aren't ready. But the police are using that imbalance to basically manipulate the information flow instead of just getting back to the drawing board and working together. Because my understanding is that the state's attorney's office is willing to work with law enforcement and give them the tools they need, warrants, you know, CIs, whatever they need in order to continue to pursue these cases. You know, because they can close the case, or they can call it a continuing investigation. And the state's attorney is willing to call it a continuing investigation to give them more time. And law enforcement is literally throwing up their hands and saying, well, screw it, we don't want to do it anymore because you didn't take what we gave you. And that's just not right. You know, it's not about the state's attorney at the end of the day. It's about the family of that 7-year-old and that 6-year-old who deserve justice. And if law enforcement is getting as much resources as it gets from the city, we need them to step up and fulfill their mission, even under difficult circumstances. Go out and get that evidence, and let's bring these folks to justice.
Right. And it's also it's also about Black Lives Matter. The cops are upset because they can't shoot us at will or beat the living daylights out of us anytime they feel like it.
Well, there's political realities. There's political conflicts outside, as Monroe has alluded to just right there, outside the box of these specific cases. And I've written about this and talked about this. The police union, Fraternal Order of Police, is sort of the outpost for MAGA in the city of Chicago. And Kim Fox was elected, as to Monroe's point, out of protests from the Laquan McDonald shooting. So if anything, she represents a more benevolent attitude when it comes to enforcing law and not just locking people up. And these two sides are at loggerheads. The Fraternal Order of Police was active the Jussie Smollett counterattack against Kim Fox that did not work to unseat her, but she's still dealing with the consequences of it. So there's political realities to all this too, Jason Monroe. I mean, Chicago's a very political city. You can't just ignore the political realities that there's people going to be running. I wouldn't be surprised if Ray Lopez runs for mayor in 2023, and his issue will be crime and how the police have had their hands tied by the judges that are won't hold people in jail. They let them out on bond, and lack of prosecution. I just feel as though it's politics at this stage, and not law enforcement. Take it away, Jason.
Yeah, you know, but this is too big. Like, this is too big for politics, in my opinion. Like, we're talking about, you know, we're on track for 800 murders. You know, we've got more murders than New York and LA combined. We've got children being murdered. Like, this is a major, major problem. We've got neighborhoods in Chicago where the murder rate is, you know, Guatemala, Honduras level, you know, because it's so concentrated. So to me, Ray Lopez, like, I'm actually not even condemning Ray Lopez. I have many disagreements on many issues. I will say that I do believe that Ray Lopez cares about this issue. I do believe he cares about trying to keep people safe in the community. But all I'm asking for Ray to do is to really think about what it's going to take in order to bring safety. And he's too well versed on these issues to just fall in line with police propaganda and not look into those issues himself. He needs to request a meeting with the state's attorney's office and actually talk about some of these cases, because I think he will learn that there is more work needed to build the type of cases that can bring convictions. And we need to look at what we can do if we need to help law enforcement do that. One of the biggest problems that we have in these cases is that you don't have good witnesses, right? A good witness is frankly not like an eyewitness who is down the street, because those things never hold up. You basically need somebody who was intimately involved in the situation, who knows the suspect, who knows what the motive is, who heard him talking. And those are the type of people that we can never seem to find, because obviously they have many reasons why they don't want to testify, because they're probably somehow involved or they're gang involved or et cetera. But that's what the job of good law enforcement does, is you develop these relationships, you develop these informants, you develop things to where you might have a chance to turn somebody or flip somebody or get them to give you something and participate. That's the hard part of policing. I get it. But that's ultimately what it's going to take. And we need to figure out what can we do to support law enforcement and being able to do that. And one of the things, as Moreau talked about, is that you need to kind of really get back to constitutional policing, because one of the things that completely closes that off is the amount of abuse and other things that meets out that so soils relationships that you can't get anywhere, right? You've got to have some rapport. And we need people operating in these communities that are able to go out there and build relationships that can be used over time. And if we can do that, then we will have the type of cases we need to bring some of these folks to justice. And so all I'm asking Alderman Lopez to do is to be proactive. I mean, to be constructive in his efforts to bring more safety to the city.
Okay. Let me have quickie here. When I was press secretary, the thing I learned was that the most powerful position in the CPD is detective. And so there were very few black detectives. Almost all the detectives were mm-hmm, white. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that's where the power is. You decide what the crime was, who should be investigated. I mean, it's a very important position. And therefore, blacks don't get promoted to that. My guess is the numbers aren't that different now than they were 30 years ago. I don't know for sure. I haven't looked into it. But the thing is, what Jason is pointing out could be solved if you had more black detectives with connections in those communities where there's a problem. And I'm going to be surprised if there are a lot of detectives in those areas.
I think that's a great point, and one more thing that we need to look at.
Monroe Anderson, former press secretary to Eugene Sawyer, mayor of the city of Chicago from 1987 to 1989, made a hell of a mistake with Chicago when you didn't reelect him, in my humble opinion. And it is my show, so I get to close with my humble opinion. 3,100 shootings this year, Jason Lee, up from 2,849 last year, and 1,838 in 2019. And homicides so far through this year, I took the numbers down because I wanted to. I knew we were going to have this conversation, though I forgot to bring it up. So thank you for bringing it up. 535 homicides. So we have a serious problem here in the city of Chicago. And it doesn't get any better, just to put it mildly, when the state's attorney's office is under siege from the police department. And you're right, Jason, that you can't get into the specifics in many instances, because it would just ruin the case in many instances. All right. Very good. Jason Lee, thank you so much. Monroe Anderson, every Wednesday here on the Ben Jarofsky Show. Thank you very much. And I want to thank the man, DJ Nate, sitting in for Dennis. Dr. D took the day off. He did a great job dealing with Monroe, Ben, and Jason, and hooking us up together. So I think Monroe and Jason will agree when I say, DJ Nate, give yourself a raise, take it out of petty cash. See you tomorrow, everybody.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.